This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we have economics professor Rick Wolf talking to us about austerity here in the U.S. and abroad. What happened to tax the rich or chicken in every pot? Now we have don't tax the rich, give the chickens to the rich. Hear about it from Rick Wolf. We'll also speak with Harlem activist Nellie Hester Bailey on her two-year evaluation of the Obama administration. We'll hear about the oxymoron, progressives for Obama.
Stay with us.
We want to bring our listeners up to date on the latest regarding Lynn Stewart. Michael?
Well, I visited Lynn 2 weeks ago, right before she was sent to a federal medical center in Carswell, Texas. It's right outside of Fort Worth. She was designated, that is, they told her that they're going to ship her out right before Christmas and take her away from her family, but she didn't know where they were going to send her. She was hoping for Danbury, Connecticut, which is an hour train ride outside of New York City. And the worst place they could have sent her is this place called Carswell. It's a federal prison hospital outside of Fort Worth, Texas. And in fact, that's where they sent her. Now, she did write a letter, and her husband, Ralph Pointer, put it up on his website, and we'll link to it on lawanddisorder.org. And Lynn says that she's doing pretty good. The food is better. She can see the moon. There are birds chirping. She asked people to send her books about birds in the South. She seemed in very high spirits, which has been characteristic of Lynn. She really is brave. And she sent out her address, which I'm going to give you, because she would love hearing from you. That's Lynn Stewart. Her prison number is 53504-054, FMC Carswell, Federal Medical Center, Post Office Box 27137, Fort Worth, Texas, 76127. And we'll put it up on lawanddisorder.org. Send Lynn a note. Express your support for her. She told me, she said, I'm walking out of here. She could keep her head high for the next 8 years. She'll get out of there.
Thank you, Michael, for that important update about Lynn. And please, send Lynn letters. Send Lynn books. Stay in touch.
Michael, a couple of weeks ago, we interviewed Steve Hendricks, who wrote the very fine book, A Kidnapping in Milan. There's an update on that.
When we interviewed Steve about the U.S.-Italian rendition of Abu Omar from Italy through Germany and into the torture chambers of Egypt, there had been a trial and 23 CIA agents had been convicted of an illegal kidnapping in Italy. Of course, the United States told Italy we will never enforce any of the warrants for their arrest, and Italy never even sent them to the United States. But of course, at this point, there's 23 warrants for the arrests of CIA agents. The case went up on appeal, of course, appealed by both sides. One side wanted longer sentences, and the other side wanted the convictions thrown out. The appeals court just upheld the sentences of all 23 agents. That's not one, that's 23 CIA agents. And what did they do? They lengthened the jail time for those CIA agents. Robert Selden Lady, his sentence went from 8 years to 9 years. They added one. And the 22 other agents who had been given 5 years are now going to do 7 years if and when the Italians get their gloves on these CIA torture rendition team. So thank you, Italian courts. It does show that there can be a modicum of justice, at least in some courts in some parts of the world.
Well, Michael, there's news about Obama at Guantanamo and extending these indefinite detentions.
Well, what had always fallen between the cracks, which is to say, these 48 people who the Obama administration says they don't want to give a trial to, they don't want to charge, they just want to leave at Guantanamo, they are now putting some, it's an executive order, they're trying to put some language around those 48 people who are being kept in prison without charges and a trial. And the recent article said that the Obama administration is now preparing an executive order that will put into, quote, law, the idea that you can indefinitely or preventively detain not just these 48, but other people picked up in the so-called war on terror. So the fears that I had of Obama going in, and I wrote an article with Jules Lobel in The Nation about it called Don't Rewrap Guantanamo, Don't Just take whatever the terrible parts of Guantanamo are, which are entirely Guantanamo, is terrible, and rewrap it into some kind of legal framework and give us something new for Christmas. It looks like the Obama administration is giving at least those 48 and others potentially that fall into the grasp of the United States and the CIA a Christmas present, which is a executive order authorizing preventive detention, without trial, in other words, of people picked up in the so-called war on terror. It's outrageous. It's illegal. In my view, it should be unconstitutional in this environment. Who knows what will happen? It's one of the worst hallmarks, really, of the Bush administration and now of the Obama administration. So we're looking at really the real implementation by the Obama administration of a police state in this country. And don't kid yourself. It's not just going to be for the 48 who were picked up by Bush. It's going to be for others picked up, and it's going to be our future. So there you have it, a new executive order on preventive detention. Another word for preventive detention is essentially detention without trial, arbitrary detention, whatever you want to call it.
Michael, Bradley Manning, the U.S. Army private, is alleged to have leaked all kinds of stuff exposing the United States war in Iraq and other places. He's been in solitary confinement now for 5 months. What's the update on that?
He's 22 years old. He is actually, if you add up his time that he spent overseas, which was 2 months of solitary, and now, which was in Kuwait, and now 5 months at Quantico, Virginia, we're talking about leaving someone in a deep, dark hole for 7 months. And the most important article was written by Glenn Greenwald in Salon. It's called The Inhumane Conditions of Bradley Manning's Detention. And I just recommend it, because if you think that we turned a leaf or turned a page after we took the people at Guantanamo out of the hellhole of punitive isolation and detention, you'd be wrong. Bradley Manning is in a situation that is certainly cruel and abusive, and that many of us think amounts to torture. Bradley Manning is in sensory deprivation. He's getting sleep deprived. He doesn't even have a sheet or a pillow to sleep on. And what they're doing, they're trying to break this guy's will. They're trying to do what we have discussed on this program time and again, of the old, what Al McCoy called the techniques that the U.S. has been using to break people for scores of years, including at Guantanamo. And it's a form of torture, and people ought to object. This is outrageous. Right here in Quantico, in this country, Bradley Manning is in a hellhole. Once again, we're pleased to have Professor of Economics Rick Wolf with us to talk about the recent tax cuts to the rich, and the question of, are we in a recovery? Rick will tell us, why did Obama cut taxes for the very rich? Not just income taxes, but estate taxes as well. Rick will explain what these tax cuts mean to basic social services that many of the people in this country depend on, and he will discuss why is there so much fight back in Europe, the United Kingdom, Greece, England, and Portugal, and why is there quietude in the United States. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Rick, we're glad to see you. We wanted to talk about two things today. One, the tax bill that went down, and secondly, the possibilities of some kind of economic recovery. So let's start with the tax. What's your take on it?
Well, it is, on two levels, terribly disappointing. And the reason is the following. In order to get anything through, the president had to accommodate the richest people in the United States and the biggest corporations. What I mean is he had to pay a price, and that price is severe. And here's what I mean. He said to the wealthiest in America, if you let your representatives here in Congress, that is basically the Republican Party, if you let them vote for my bill, I will give you an extraordinary set of benefits. First of all, I will maintain the low tax rate that the Bush administration gave you. And I won't let it go up the way I had said I would in the past. I'm putting my words right. as Obama's. And even more stunning, I'm going to allow you to pass even more of your wealth to your children, the people who inherit your estate when you die, than you even asked me to do. Here's an extra gift, the estate tax, it's called. What this does is not only pander to the richest folks, but it's important to remember these are the people who did the best over the last 30 years. If you look at the last 30 years, wage earners and salary earners went nowhere. But people who were rich enough to own shares of stock and so on in the stock market made out literally like bandits. So they've been the best beneficiaries. The little bit of recovery in our economy we have over the last 3 years of crisis has gone overwhelmingly to shareholders and people at the top. So they are the people who did best in the last 30 years. They're the people who have been hurt least by the crisis. And now they are given an extra gift at a time of national crisis to deal with this whole economic meltdown. It kind of boggles the mind. Let me just give you the example of the estate tax. It was already a gift. Let me remind everyone what an estate tax is for. If you live in a society where everybody is supposed to start on a level playing field, we're all supposed to start life with roughly equal chances so that by dint of hard work and talent and applying oneself and education, we can do better or less well according to our capabilities, not according to the accident of who we were born to and who left us what kind of money he or she got in God knows what way. So all over the world, and indeed here in the United States, most of the states in the United States have an estate tax. And the idea is you can earn money for the state to run the services we all need by taxing the super rich so that they're not quite as far ahead in the rat race of life than they already will be by being rich. So we have a little bit of a movement towards a level playing field. What this last bill does is said the following. Rich people in America were already, under the pre-existing law, allowed to leave $3.5 million per member of a couple, husband and wife, to their children or anyone else they designated, and the federal government wouldn't touch it. The first $3.5 million per, so in a couple it would be $7 million. So you're now talking about less than 0.5% of Americans who even have this amount of money. So they were able to do that. This new law, just signed by President Obama, raises the amount they can leave to their kids without giving the federal government anything from $7 million per couple to $10 million per couple. But that's not all. Under the pre-existing law, if you left more than $7 million, that extra amount was taxed at the rate of 45%. The new law reduces what you have to pay tax amount on, the over $10 million, if you have that much, from 45 to 35%. What that means is, for the super rich, a gift in the millions, and for this country, a gift in the billions of dollars. And why is that important? Because those billions of dollars that are now going to be saved by the richest people in the United States are going to be the basis for arguing, and you can already see it, why the government can't maintain a Head Start program, why the government has to cut back what it does to help, you know, poor families, what the government can't give graduate students and undergraduates in the way of scholarships. We're going to be talking for the next many years about the difficulties that the government has in doing things because it doesn't have money. But it doesn't have money because it just gave away the store to the richest half of 1%.
Let me ask another question about that, because I think one of your consequences you're saying, Rick, is that it won't have the money anymore because it's given away the store. But isn't there another consequence, which is if you want to pump up the economy and get money into the economy for jobs, the worst way to do it is to give that money to the rich who then stick it into savings banks, hedge funds, whatever else they do, and not in investments. Oh. And they don't put it out in the market. They don't spend it.
Absolutely.
So it has a double effect that deprives the country of the money, and it doesn't increase spending.
Or to take an example, that's quite right, but to take an example pushes it even further. What the richest in the world do here in this country when they get a break like this and save all these millions and billions in taxes, if you listen to the right wing, they say, well, they invest it. Number one, not necessarily. That's just a guess as to what they're going to do. But let's assume that they do invest it. Well, then you have to ask yourself, where are they going to invest it? And if you turn to Wall Street these days, the hottest investments are those in
other parts of the world where the profitability is greater. So what we're doing is we're releasing money from the United States, which might have used it for the people here, to give it back to the rich who will invest it in the profitable outlets in China and Europe and Latin America. If it makes jobs anywhere, and that's a long shot, it won't make it here. So it is a kind of funding of the economic development in other parts of the world.
Why did he do it? Why did Obama do this? I mean, this is like, I mean, incredible.
The answer is the one that you have to face if you're an American these days. Both of the political parties run campaigns that cost in the hundreds of millions of dollars. We don't have big machines anymore that rely on people's elbow grease and going to meetings and going door to door. We have television. We have commercial ads. We have glitzy internet promotions. They cost huge amounts of money. If you want to contest for political office in the United States the way it is today, you need money. And Mr. Obama and the Democrats are facing a difficult election 2 years from now, and pleasing the people who have the money is a central part of their strategy. So you didn't have to twist their arms all that much to get them to throw this in. It shows that Mr. Obama, as a friend of those with the money, someone they can count on, and hopefully someone they will help when the time comes to pass the hat to run for office.
We've already talked about our second topic, recovery, a little bit, and I want to get back to it and ask you a related question. One is, what do you think is happening with this so-called recovery here in the United States, and what's going on in Europe, and does it teach us anything?
I think the recovery here is largely a mirage. To be fair, banks have recovered real well, and the stock market has done pretty well, too, over the last year and a half. In coming back. And those are two closely related things, since major players in the stock market are playing with the money that the banks now have again to play with. But that's all. Beyond that, in terms of the vast mass of the American people, unemployment is as high as it was a year ago. In fact, last month it went up the most recent time. Foreclosures are running at a multi-million clip per year. So in terms of the vast mass of people, the situation is a disaster. And the proof of it is the following. Last month, the Federal Reserve decided to print another $600 billion worth. They would never have had to do that if we were in a recovery of any quality, because that's an admission that the previous efforts didn't work, and they have to, already at a time when they've printed a lot of money that worries people, print even more. And the second index is the same tax bill we just discussed, because what that does is, by cutting everybody's taxes, particularly the super rich, and by helping a few people, businesses and the unemployed who get a few more weeks of help, you're basically breaking the bank of the federal government. It's more deficit spending. And that wouldn't have been necessary, and that wouldn't have been done unless it was clear that the economy had not recovered. So we don't need comments by folks like me. It's the very actions of a government that claimed the last time it printed money and did deficit spending that it would suffice, and is now showing us, by having to do it again, that the earlier one just didn't work. So my view is, we've got years of unemployment ahead of us, years of a disastrous housing market, very few signs of recovery. And the worst, perhaps, is what hasn't hit yet. There is a delay between a crisis and its impact at the state and local level. It takes time for those budgets to crumble. For example, every city and town in America, all 36,000 of them, are dependent on what's called a property tax. They tax the land, the buildings, the homes. As those go down in value, and these cities and towns have to deal with that, their tax revenue from a depreciated value of their land and property is going to cut into their revenues on top of what they're already losing. Their situation is dire. You have now, for the first time in my lifetime, serious anxiety in Wall Street that the municipal bond market, the debts of cities and states and towns, is going to see significant defaults in the United States, freaking out the people who have invested in those kinds of securities, and everybody else wondering what in the world is going to happen in these cities and towns, because that's where, in a sense, the economy is really impacting people's lives. Teachers are being laid off. Police and fire are laid off. Social workers, crossing guards, school program, you name it. And in some states, like California, it's already a disaster, and that's coming. You know, New York State is about to lay off huge numbers of people with the new regime, confrontations with public employee unions. The most unionized sector of the American economy is the one to be targeted now as all these cutbacks impact them. You're facing a situation in which what we really count on, the local government to provide us with those services that are daily parts of our lives, are going to be cutting them and laying off public employees, which worsens the unemployment problem. So I see a situation in the United States in which we are constantly being told that recovery is around the corner. We see it affecting only a very small number of people, and we're kind of back in a discredited idea that was discredited once before in the 20th century. This is the notion of so-called trickle-down. If you help the banks, if you help rich people, if you help the stock market, it will trickle down and we will all eventually be caught up in it. It wasn't true in the past. It was a theory that was ridiculed, but it's basically what Republicans and Democrats are offering to us at this time, and I think it'll be at the state and local level that some of the biggest pressures come. One last point. Most pensions in this country come from state and local government. We know already that the Social Security program is under attack and being whittled down. What people don't understand is that the pensions at the state and local level are now estimated to be, I didn't make this up, this is from the Pew Charitable Trust who do this research, $1 trillion in debt. What does that mean? The commitments legally binding upon the states and cities for pensions that they've committed to their employees past and present is $1 trillion more than the revenue coming in to sustain any of that. That's going to have to either mean jacking up the taxes on the mass of people, which cities and towns simply can't do, or turning to present workers and to already retired people and letting them know that they're going to be getting less. I just want to remind folks here, if you're not familiar, in 2008, only 8 states in America took the drastic step of cutting benefits to retirees. In 2009, it went up to 12. In 2010, and we're not finished with that year, it's 19 states have already begun the process or taken the steps to cut back on retirees. Not only is that breaking a promise to people who've given you all their productive lives, but that's really the least of it. Just remember, if you do that, here are the consequences. Number one, the retired people have to go back into the labor force because they can't live on the reduced benefits. That means a new group of people who are desperate will be competing for the jobs that aren't there. And that will worsen our unemployment in a number of ways. Number two, for every one of these retired people who gets a job, that's an unemployed or a new young person entering the market who can't find a job. And number three, when you're a retired person, can't work or can't find a job, here's the little news that you have to remember. They will do what retired people used to do before there was a Social Security system. They will go back to their children and request, demand, or beg for the kinds of resources that their children are less capable of giving to them now than they have been for 30 years, so that this problem will not be limited to the retiree. It'll be a problem on the whole society and is part of what is building so that the crisis politically and socially that is coming out of this economic crisis is just at its earliest stages, which is why all talk of recovery is really an attempt to distract people from what is underway.
Now, Michael referred to the reactions, I mean, obliquely, but in Europe, to these kind of austerity measures, this kind of non-recovery, et cetera. And, of course, we've seen that in England. We've seen it in France. We've seen it in other countries. And you were referring sort of, we're just seeing the beginning of the political and social problems. But why has there been so little reaction? It's just that people seem to be just getting plowed over by this.
Well, in Europe, they haven't been. There are huge, violent often, because the violence is what gets, you know, noticed in this country. But let me just go through it. There have been general strikes, that is, coordinated actions in the cities across a country by trade unions, by left-wing political parties, and by concerned citizens in at least the following countries that I know of: Greece, Portugal, Spain, Ireland, France, Italy, and Belgium. I'm sure there are others, but those are the ones I'm familiar with. That's an extraordinary statement to make for a two-year period just finished. I can't think of a time in Europe ever when you've had that kind of a statement that was the case. We even had on the 29th of September a European-wide action, and another one, or two of them actually, are being planned now. Many of them are not reported in the United States. Many of them are coordinated with election efforts. So to give you an example, the two most important powerful economies in Europe, France and Germany, if you look at the public opinion polls, then the two governments there, Sarkozy in France and Merkel in Germany, will lose at the next national election because there is so much anger. And the gainers, the parties projected to win, are the left-wing parties. Socialists in both countries, the socialist parties, are expected to make major gains. And with their allies, who are also expected to make major gains, the Greens and the far left, the anti-capitalist party, big one in Germany, the Die Linke, but a fast-growing one in France as well. So you can see the effect because this entire campaign is on one subject, what in Europe is called austerity, the generic term, the slogan term, to describe the government pushing the burdens of this crisis onto the mass of people, having bailed out the rich and the powerful. The United States is not going to be immune to this. As the situation gets worse here, we're going to be seeing more and more signs of mass alternatives being wanted by majorities of the public in Europe, and it's going to be a very difficult situation in this country.
Well, you know, the conclusion that I draw from this, and I think you and Michael do also, they have a mechanism to organize resistance in the various European countries, and we don't.
Unquestionably, I can't see any other argument. In Europe, they have functioning left-wing political parties, Socialist Party, Green Party, Communist Party, Anti-Capitalist Party, and there are others. And they exist, and they exist across these countries, in cities, in towns. They have offices, they have meetings, they have candidates who have won office, et cetera, et cetera. They have a functioning trade union movement, which, while it is weaker than it once was, has not suffered anything like the decline of the labor movement in the United States. So they have the organizations in place with the offices and the staffs and the people and the mechanisms so that they can rally and mobilize their populations. I don't think the sentiment in the United States is all that different from Europe, to tell you the truth, but we do lack those organizations. So we cannot mobilize. We do not have the mechanisms in place, kind of a lesson, if you like, in the importance of maintaining organization, because you need it in order to be able to act at historical moments that are moments where people need action. And I think millions of Americans would be very quick to flock to anything like a progressive version of what is happening in Europe to happen here, or of progressive counterpart to a Tea Party movement here that was able and willing to say what had to be said, but not from a right wing, but from a left wing perspective, because every other country in Europe is experiencing this. There's no reason why the United States wouldn't.
I agree with you. I think that conditions are overripe. You can't make a mass, nationally coordinated organization. You can't create that overnight. But you certainly can do it at a local level. You can certainly start now. I know that you're active in trying to do that here in New York, Rick Wolf. If people who are in listening range of our voices come to grips with that problem, someday, hopefully, somehow, there'll be some coordination and some coordinated resistance on our part.
I do think that public employees and those who value the public services they get from the schools, from hospitals, from all the agencies of government are going to have to face that they're going to be charged more money, they're going to be given less services. They're going to see their friends and neighbors who work for the government and try to do useful things lose their jobs, lose their job security. And at some point, the fight back at the local immediate level is going to understand how it needs to link up with others if it's going to have any chance. That's an insight that's central to all collective efforts. It's the insight that makes a worker finally decide, gee, a union where we would all get together to talk to the boss is a more effective thing than me arguing individually with the boss. And the same thing applies. Me by myself with City Hall is not as effective as me together with other people who have some shared grievances here approaching that. And that insight, America Americans are perfectly well capable of making, as Europeans are. And I think we will have to learn the lesson that having allowed our union and left organizations to atrophy for 30 years was a terrible disservice to ourselves and our children. And that we need to reconstruct these organizations and in a hurry in order to salvage something out of this. Let me put it another way, which is scary, but I think it has to be faced. The flow of jobs out of the United States to other parts of the world where workers are cheaper is continuing. It has never stopped. It happened before the crisis. It contributed to the crisis. And the crisis has made it even more urgent for many employers to do that. So we're developing a society in which more and more of the work is shifted abroad, and that leaves less and less of the American people with jobs. In the old days, we would have worried about that by saying, well, after all, if those Americans don't have jobs, they won't be able to buy stuff, and the corporations need to sell the stuff. Yeah, but that's the new world economy. American corporations don't see the United States as a quote-unquote growth area, a market expanding. They see it as a growth declining, market shrinking place. They're focused elsewhere. They're going to service all those economies that are booming around the world, developing their own little new middle classes of well-paid workers. That's their future. That's where they're going. It's not just that Americans are moving jobs abroad, much more dangerous for us as a nation. They're moving their whole planning, their whole future, where they see they're going to sell products to another part of the world. So when you tell them, well, gee, there won't be Americans to buy your stuff, they look at you in a funny way and they smile and they say, that's really too bad, but I got lots of customers elsewhere. Yeah. And that's where I'm going. And that means the United States has a special position in the world. Higher skill, higher income, that's gone. We're becoming like the rest of the world we used to think we were so different from. We're becoming a society in which a large number of people live on the edges and the margins. No one cares about them, neither to employ them nor to sell to them. They just sit there. You've had that in many other parts of the world for a long time. It's a new experience in this country after almost a century of being a little different from that, having that middle class we all talk to. But there's a long process of decline in which the United States is being shoved back into a position it thought it had escaped. But as long as you allow private enterprise to move their investments wherever the profits are the best, to take whatever steps they think are good for their private interest, and you leave the social consequences for the rest of us to clean up, you're going to have this kind of situation, and it's staring the United States in the face in a way that ought to make everyone really concerned about the future of the next 20, 30 years here.
Well, Rick, you've been shockingly clear to people, as you always are on the show. What I'd like you to do is just tell people a little about your website and your latest book.
Well, you know, the response has been so encouraging to folks like me that, yes, I did develop a website where address is rdwolf, spelled WOLFF.com, rdwolf.com. All the work I do, the radio interviews, the television interviews, classes I teach, short 5-minute and 20-minute videos that are presented and prepared in order to make these issues clear, I put it all on that website. It's all available there all the time, no charge whatsoever. It's designed to be a resource for everyone who wants to understand what is going on in the economy on an ongoing basis. And so, yes, I invite people to make use of that website, to let other people know about it, because if you find this stuff interesting and important, as I surely hope you do, that's a place where you can get updated analysis of what's going on all the time, including the topics we've just discussed here.
There's a sleeping giant out there waiting to be addressed by people like you. And we at Law & Disorder hope you'll wake him up. Thanks for being our guest.
And thank you for having a show like this that is such an important alternative source of insight and inspiration at a time when we surely need it.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
There's a long list of items progressive Americans had hoped to accomplish through the Obama administration. In our interview with Roger Hodge, author of The Mendacity of Hope, Barack Obama and the Betrayal of American Liberalism, Hodge says Obama didn't fight for anything worth fighting for. With corporate backers such as Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and Citigroup, the Obama administration has been severely compromised. These corporations expect something in return. The Obama administration has been criticized for expanding the wars abroad from Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Yemen. It's been criticized for continuing the Guantanamo detention policies, the Wall Street bailouts, and bargaining with the health care bill as a bailout for insurance companies. In this aftermath of 2010, and looking back to 2008, we're joined by Nellie Hester Bailey, director of the Harlem Tenants Council, to evaluate the last 2 years of the Obama administration. Nellie, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
Nellie, I was at a party 2 years ago, and they were counting votes right after the presidential election. I was one of the few people at the party who actually did not vote for Obama, but a lot of people were most enthusiastic about his getting elected. In fact, one of my friends went up to Harlem to celebrate. Well, 2 years have gone by now. What was your take on Obama then and now?
Well, my take on presidential candidate Barack Obama during his campaign, he was nothing more than a brown, very new, very different, historic, face a browner hue of imperialism. But in fact, the policy of the U.S. government at home and abroad would remain the same. And I think if we are to be critical in our analysis, when we look at the statement and platform of then presidential candidate Barack Obama, he was very clear that he was a centrist candidate. And in many instances, he was to the right of center. Amazingly enough, in some instances, to the right of Hillary Clinton, if one can imagine that. We were never taken in. We were never mesmerized. We were never blinded in this historic first politics in the U.S. We knew very well who he was and what policies he would, in fact, support. And that is corporate America, the globalization and exploitation of poorer nations. We knew instinctively who and what this man was. And in fact, he has proven himself to be in many ways much worse than what we had anticipated, but not for me, but for some of my other colleagues and comrades who were cautiously optimistic that in fact he has turned out to be much worse than what was expected.
You're not disappointed because you never had expectations, is that
no,
right?
No, no, I'm not disappointed at all. It isn't something that I rejoice in, but there is a certain amount of retribution for those who went so totally overboard that there is a I told you so retort that, in fact, we put forth now. On the 20th of January, President Barack Obama is going to deliver his State of the Union address. It is all over the internet, and everyone expects that this is going to be the prelude for another deadly compromise against working class and poor Americans, and that is a cut, the anticipated cut in Social Security. That is coming, and the buzzword on the internet, it will come in his State of the Union address. And so as we see these draconian policies of his, even in many ways, much worse than that of George Bush, because there would have been an uproar, this right-wing Republican, but there has been a sweetener added to the bitterness of this liquid. There was a piece in the Guardian, I don't know whether or not it originated there, but there was a study done, it was reported in the Guardian, that's where I first read it, a survey on African Americans, and amazingly, it concluded that African Americans were much more optimistic about their economic situation and felt much more secure under Barack Obama's administration than ever before, when in fact, just the opposite is true. African Americans are in a much worse economic situation than ever before, even under President George Bush. African Americans have lost trillions of dollars in wealth in the housing crisis, the mortgage scam. And we're going to see that implode, I think, as we are beginning to see now. Trillions of dollars. And this was their step up in terms of creating wealth, not only for themselves, but also for their children and future generations. That has been totally wiped out. We have to remember that it was President Barack Obama who gave the banks a free ride. Can we imagine $12 trillion to Wall Street and to the banksters? $12 trillion. We have added $900 billion to the deficit with this tax cut deal, that is extending the tax cuts to the 2% of the wealthy. That's what he did. And we are supposed to believe that he did this for us, the poor and the working class of this country, when just the opposite is true. And we have more of that betrayal. We have more of that treachery in store for us in the 2 years that are left in his presidency. And unlike the right wing, I believe he will be a one-term president, but obviously not for the same reasons that they are touting.
I believe that, too. What are you trying to do? What organizations do you work with? And what are you trying to do to kind of coalesce that consciousness that you have and teach people and try to bring about an alternative to just voting for the lesser of two evils, which turns out to be not so lesser?
Well, that's very interesting, and I think there are a number of parts to that answer that I'm going to give. You are undoubtedly aware of the letter that originated with, I think his name is Paul Halley. He is a professor at Bard College, and this letter was sent out almost a month ago. And it called upon basically the progressives for Obama, i.e. Bill Fletcher, Tom Hayden, Barbara Ehrenreich, to look at Obama for what he is, and in fact called upon them specifically to support the December 15th action, Veterans for Peace, that was in Washington, D.C. There was a demonstration in front of the White House. About 131 people were arrested in that protest. It was not covered by the media at all. And Halley wants to get about 5,000 signatures on that letter. He has close to 4,000 now. The response from Tom Hayden has been rather visceral. Who are you to talk to me like this? Bill Fletcher is very upset, yet they continue in this vein of progressives for Obama to support his policy and not pulling back, because what we need most of all for poor and working people, and in particular African Americans, is for the blinders to be pulled off so that people can see actually what it is that we are dealing with, and that President Barack Obama is no longer sugarcoated as the historic first. He's our black president. No matter what he does, we are going to support him. When at the same time, as we see the collapse of the empire, and I think there's an inevitability in all of that, when you look at the unsustainable wars that we are engaged in, when you look at the move to the right domestically with that of the Republican agenda, which means more civil rights repression against the populace here, when you look at the economic demise of so many Americans, which is why white America is so upset, because their standard of living has declined dramatically. When you look at the recent report, I believe, from the Center for Disease Control, that now we have more than a 50% increase in the number of people who are uninsured. And when you look at all of these factors, and the workforce has been reduced, we are expected to work longer hours, we are expected to retire later in life. In fact, we are being worked to death, and our kids are being sent to war. And if you are an immigrant, and if you want the Dream Act, if you want to become an American citizen, then prove to us that you are willing to die. And if you do die, then we will grant you citizenship. These are the realities, the undeniable realities that we are looking at when we look at and when we embrace the Obama administration. Now, what it is that we can do, we can support the initiatives of Hallie. We can put those straddling liberal progressives on the sideline by saying, you no longer can lull the people or herd the people like sheep into this nightmare of compromise, which in fact is our demise from the Obama administration. What we can do, and this is a big problem we have in the African-American community, because upon his election, one noted activist here in New York City said, you know, President Obama gave us a wink and a nod. You know, he knows, and we can expect the best out of him. And Michelle is going to make him do right, and Michelle will do. I mean, this soap opera scenario and daydreaming, which is just incomprehensible. And particularly when you look at the left, we're talking about the Marxist left, that there was no class and race analysis about this man's presidency. How can one call themselves and declare themselves a Marxist and you support President Barack Obama? How is that possible? What was the failure of the left? Why was the left so blinded by this historic first African-American president? Well, we had Condoleezza Rice as the first, and we saw what fruit that bore. It was not a good fruit.
Why do you think it happened? I mean, I understand. Your analysis is quite clear, quite sharp, and one could even argue that the powers that be got Obama in to essentially suppress the progressive movement and the African-American community that would have diverted it. And it created this whole tension about should we do this or not. But why do you think people missed it so much? Particularly, I mean, there are a lot of good people who you know, your friends, who were certainly on the fence, if not worse, in terms of their thinking this was going to be the great savior.
I'm at a loss. I mean, when you look at people whom I love dearly, Amiri Baraka. I mean, how do you explain that?
That one's a hard one.
Fletcher, he straddled the fence here and there. Yeah, you know, you can, okay. But people like Baraka, some of the other noted left winger, a long history and tradition of Marxist analysis, how is that possible? One of the excuses we heard was, the people are for him. We don't want to display this vanguard elitism. These forces, progressives for Obama, need to step back and realize their responsibility to building a working class people, multiracial movement to take on this system that is declining, that is in collapse. It is not sustainable. We see the desperation every single day. And it seems to me that if they cannot wake up at this point, then a large part of the movement that we're trying to build that Micah talked about, we saw it from the very beginning that you are talking about, that others are talking about, that we are all going to be doomed, not unless conditions force the populace into the streets, as we are seeing in Ireland, as we're seeing in England, as we're seeing throughout Europe, as we're seeing in Greece, as we're seeing in France. And if conditions don't drive people into the street, that there comes a point that they can no longer tolerate the assault on their lives and their civil liberties, then we are, in fact, doomed. And I'm not too optimistic, but as Che said, if you are a revolutionary, then we are full of optimism. And so I am optimistic, but it is a hard road ahead of us.
Well, Nellie Hester Bailey, my favorite quote on that subject is Gramsci's: pessimism of the intellect, but optimism of the heart.
Yes.
But when I speak and people ask me, well, what should I do? I say, well, you should look around and find a compatible organization and join it. Mm-hmm. And if you can't find one, make one. But work together collectively with other people. What do you tell people?
Well, what we tell people uptown, and we've had a series of, I would call them, educational forums and town hall meeting. For example, at our housing conference that was held 3 or 4 months ago at the Schomburg Center, it was a housing conference, but one of the things that we talked about in the opening address was the collapse of empire and what that meant for tenants and people in general. Because if you live in cities and large part of the population live in cities, you're going to live in rental housing. It is about the collapse of empire and where do we go from there? Because you cannot look at a single one of these social justice struggles and not see it intrinsically linked to all of the other struggles. Yeah. Because if you don't have a job, you're not going to have housing. If you're not part of your community, then you're going to have the assaults against your school. We're seeing the privatization of municipal assets, public education, public housing. And just let me say this very quickly. In terms of the privatization of municipal assets and federal assets. And it was through the Obama administration and the stimulus bill that we now have a major public housing project in Harlem, Grant Houses, that is now owned by Citigroup, which is the third largest bank in the country, and received $2.2 trillion of the stimulus or the bank bailout. So that's a very real connection. So what we try to do is really part of our mandate, as I see it, is to educate our constituents, because people often can't connect the dots or don't have, not that they can't connect the dots, they don't have the information to connect the dots. So what we talk about is, one, information is power. So you got to go out there, you got to learn this information. You can do it with events that we put on. You can do it by going to the Breck Forum. You can tune in to Progressive Radio. You can tune in to WBAI special programs, Democracy Now!, in which we can call this information and we can filter through this information and really see what the facts really are. And then it's about organizing. And as you said earlier, because you have to start with the basics, you have to become a part of something more than just yourself. You have to commit to a movement. You have to commit to a struggle. And you don't do that on an individual basis. You do it as a collective movement. And that's how you move ahead. And then calling for progressive forces to come together. New York City, as we all know, is one, the political landscape, particularly with respect to the progressive political landscape, is extremely fragmented. And how does one even begin to pull people together to even talk? I know it's very, very difficult in the African-American community. And oftentimes in the smaller movements, you're dealing with misogyny in terms of the leadership. You're dealing with a elitism, almost of a cultish nature. We have the answer and we're going to put it out there and you're going to follow us and that's it. And nobody else has a voice. And I am always so amazed, and this is one of the things that we have to fight against is the lack of participatory democracy in the social justice movement, that the decisions and the analysis is from on top, and it is rarely from the bottom up, from the grounds up. And that's what you need. You need people to talk about things. You need to engage people and not to impose policy and analysis against our constituents or the general populace. So this lack of participatory democracy in some of these movements, I think, is appalling and has led not to the enrichment or the building these movements into something strong and forceful and principle, most of all, principle unity is something that is just off the scale here in New York City.
I know you're part of an internet radio show, Progressive Radio. Will you share that with our audience, please?
Yes, thank you very much. I co-host a program with Glenn Ford, who is the executive editor of Black Agenda Report, which is an online news service.
You're kidding. I didn't know. Now I put it together, Glenn Ford, Black Agenda Report. People should check it.
I am so honored to be the co-host with Glenn Ford, who is one of the leading Black intellectuals here in this country, along with Bruce Dixon and Margaret Kimberly. It is Black Agenda Report that is on Progressive Radio. We air on Mondays at 6 p.m.
If you want something really fresh, go there. I only discovered this probably in the last 2 months, I'll bet.
It's incredible.
And when I went there, it was just shockingly good. And it's like a slap across the face is not the right way to say it, but that's how it felt reading really the straight, honest truth about what's really going on. It's a great site.
I second that. BlackAgendaReport.com. And we'll link to it on our website, lawanddisorder.org.
Thank you so much.
Nellie Hester Bailey, it's been a real joy to have you on our program. I think we're on the same page here, and we very much admire you for your thinking, your clear thinking, your hard work. Do you have any last words for our audience before
we wrap it up? We want you to stay tuned to Black Agenda Report. Also, you can visit the website of Harlem Tenants Council, www.harlemtenantscouncil.org. We're going to have a town hall meeting in Harlem, and this is after the 20th State of the Union address of President Barack Obama. That information will be forthcoming. We're going to have Glenn Ford. We hope to have other intellectuals like Paul Street. It's going to be an incredible program, and hopefully we will be able to get the information to you folks as well.
Really wonderful interview with you, Nellie. So
thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again or hear a segment you've missed, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. Now you should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook. Become a friend and send Law and Disorder to your friends through Facebook.